You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Jorge Pardo. He's a sculptor who lives between Mexico and New York, and currently he's in New York. Jorge, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting me for the interview.
To begin with, what is it that you're currently involved in? What's happening in your studio now?
We are involved in a handful of projects of all different types, and everything from commissions to exhibitions that are coming up in this year to proposals, general stuff. We do a lot of things at the same time. Some projects take a month to do. Some projects take years to do. So it's really kind of a lot of different things, and we have a fair amount to do in the next couple of years.
Is there a particular show that you're excited about, or museum or otherwise, that you're designing or building now? You obviously have a team that you're working with.
Yeah, I have a small team that I work with, about 7 or 8 people, and maybe a little more if you count everybody. But we're working on there's a project in L.A., in Malibu, which is actually on the Ventura County line that we're doing, which is kind of a compound for a collector, which includes a series of buildings. And projects like that takes about 2, 3, 4 years to do. And it's kind of interesting because your kind of involvement is kind of day-to-day, but also kind of for a long time and bits and bits and bits. And I like projects like that. That just kind of a lot of decisions for a long time.
You sound like a very, relaxed guy, that everything's under control. And at the same time, I imagine this is, an incredible schedule. You're working, like an architect, like a designer, as well as an artist building in a studio. Is that not at all overwhelming to you, or is it easy to manage so many things at once for you?
I've gotten used to it. I think it used to maybe generate some anxiety when I first started doing stuff, the projects kind of grew on top of each other. But after a while, you kind of learn to manage them, and you actually kind of enjoy the process of just having a lot of different things to make decisions about throughout the day. So it's more fun than overwhelming, I guess.
There was one thing that I wanted to ask you about, because I hadn't seen it before, is the sub-lamp, the subscription lamp on your website. I saw the assembly of it, and it was beautiful. I thought I'd love to have one of those, but there was also something kind of charming and, to me, entertaining about kind of having a tutorial video. Can you tell me a little bit about that lamp and what that process is about?
Yeah, that was part of, like you said, the subscription process of edition, which is basically it was an edition where you would sign up, and it was like $6,000 or something, and you would get a lamp every couple of months. You didn't know what the lamp was going to be; you just knew that there was going to be a lamp. And then the last one, I believe that one you're talking about is actually one that you sort of assemble yourself. And we send a lot of pieces out that have to be assembled. It's always a pain in the ass because everybody's afraid to touch art and stuff. So it makes everything that's simple really complicated. Sometimes I thought maybe I'll just make a video and do it. It'll sort of just make it easier. We won't hear as much from people. So that's sort of what it's about at the end. I mean, it's not about anything. It's trying to sort of be pragmatic about this thing. It was actually, wasn't it? It was a lamp in the sense it was a candelabra, but it was a very natural reason to make a video. It wasn't really like a video to be like video art or any of that stuff. It's just sort of, it's really like an instructional video. It is an instructional video. So.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating, and I don't know why it made me smile. It looked like one of those things that is somewhat simple to assemble, but at the same time, It's kind of a puzzle. It also looks to me like, as much as I would think I could assemble that easily, I would also get confused and think, it's the parts look.
Well,
so similar.
The thing is, it's incredibly simple to assemble. It's also incredibly simple to assemble it wrong and think that it's still something. So it's kind of funny that way.
So that's a fascinating model too. And I want to talk about earlier work, but right now, that idea of a subscription is also, a really interesting way to engage the public, your collector base, people who appreciate your work. Was that the first type of subscription thing you did like that?
That was actually the second edition of the subscription edition, second version of the subscription edition. I'll probably do another one the next year or so. And, yeah, it was just, I thought, you know, I don't really want to do an edition that I know what I'm going to have to do for the next year or two. I would like to just kind of, you know, in the edition kind of introduce the kind of the procession that happens in the studio and how things evolve and things like that. So I thought, let's try it and see if it works. And, you know, you sort of just, if they just start, you just have one lamp and you just say, well, there's going to be more coming. And I like getting things in the mail that, like, you know, I belong to wine clubs and stuff like that. So it's really fun to get something you sign up for, but you're not quite sure what it is. And it's I thought this would be a nice way to sort of, you know, spur art.
Right, I agree. I also love getting things in the mail. I'm in a vinyl of the month club, you know, also a wine club. You know, it's fascinating what's out there.
And it's also kind of a more low key model for something. I mean, I was actually surprised that, you know, the first ones we had about the edition was around 60s. The second one was about 90 or something. It ended up being a lot of work. I didn't think that many people would subscribe, and because the first one took forever to get out, and the second one was easier because we sort of had fixed all the problems of the first one. So it was interesting.
Right. Well, I think there is something exciting about getting something unknown in the mail, but also it's a way of working with people who are fans of your work or interested in your work without them commissioning or buying a certain piece. It's they're really paying for your vision as opposed to a particular work, which is also a different way of interacting.
I think that's what people do when they buy a work. Except it's sort of concretized in a gallery or in front of them or on Arts Row, they would buy it. And, but it's, you know, my work is a little bit different sometimes in the sense that, you know, you see something and it's sort of, it's stuck to something. It's on a wall. It's a place. It's something that's an installation. Something that's going down. So it's not impossible to sell, but it's not a painting, let's say, or it's not an object. It's not something that, you know, lives in a crate, whether somebody has it or not. And it really is. And I think that was also one of the interesting things to me about the edition was that it could sort of encompass that aspect of an installation, but at the same time it would sort of turn into an object.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. So let's move back a little bit. You you went to school in California, but even before that, what, you know, you have a kind of fascinating way of seeing the world to me, of seeing your medium. Was there childhood experiences with art, you think, that in any way began to form that?
You know, I did art as a kid, like everybody else does. And I remember my brother and I used to love to draw. And according to our art, like grade school art teachers, we were pretty good. She always said, you know, you guys have to take art in high school. And I didn't, because, you know, I came from a kind of a working, very working class family. You know, my parents are both factory workers and immigrants, and, you know, we spoke Spanish at home, and I didn't even know there was a kind of a viable, you know, art culture until I went to college, and then this, you know, becomes theoretical and sort of explained to you as an actual culture, but. I didn't know that they were art teachers and that got master's degrees and, you know, had made livings at universities and things like that. So that was all kind of new. And I wasn't so much interested in that. I was just interested in, you know, when I got to college, that, you know, making things was like what I liked best about my life before I went to college. I always had a shop. When I was a kid, I remember when I was 13, I asked for a table saw. For my birthday, and so for, you know, for many years I was always making things, but I didn't really know that it meant that you could be an artist with that or something. And I just liked how things work, kind of taking them apart and fixing them and making them. So.
And then when you graduated from college, you got your BFA from the Art Center at Pasadena. What happened next? Now you have this theoretical backing. You realize that there is an art world out there. what was your next steps in terms of engaging that and getting out there?
You know, when I was in college in the early mid '80s, really from '88 to '84, '84 to '88 is backwards. But the Art Center at the time was an interesting place because it was kind of a new place. But I was an undergraduate, but that was a time when the graduate program was being formed, and there were very few of us in both undergraduates, so we all kind of worked together. And it was a place where you kind of just. You had a room if you wanted, but you basically read and talked about, you know, film and a bunch of other things. It's like, you know, it was kind of one of the first or second post studio programs in the country, probably, you know, after CalArts. And in fact, most people that were at Art Center were ex CalArts professors who ended up losing their jobs because the dean left in the early '80s and fired. The group of people that then became the program at Art Center, and those people were like, you know, Jeremy Gilbert Rolfe and Richard Hertz, and at that time Mike Kelly came, and a bunch of people from LA, and it was sort of like the first non-Cal Art school that actually tried seriously to do like a post studio program, and we just made things, and we thought about them. We read about things that nobody quite understood how, you know, what the segue was in relationship to making and reading theory. But, you know, you're a kid, and you kind of do what you're supposed to do, and it's interesting because everybody's excited and blah, blah, blah. But you don't know shit with that, you know, when you're in college. And by the time you get out, you have these things, and then there's a group of people that say these are better than those, and you know this student should probably meet this person who might give them a show or things like that. And that's sort of what happened. And, you know, I was working on a group of pinhole cameras that were just kind of designed to take pictures of themselves in front of mirrors. And I remember I worked at the library at Art Center for many years after I graduated. And there was this artist, Perry Pendleberry, at the library who had gone to CalArts. And she said she was working with a dealer, this guy Tom Solomon, who had just opened a gallery in a garage in LA, and said, "You know, Harry, Tom should see these things. He should show them." And it's like, and I thought, I don't know if I understand that because I just spent 4 years in what I considered to be like a bubble that wasn't very real. But anyway, Tom came over to the studio at the time and looked at the work and offered me a show for those pieces. I said, you know, I don't really want to show these things because I don't even know if I want to be an artist. Because I think what I wanted to sort of find out and understand was whether, you know, I could make this stuff not being in a program. And that by this stuff, I mean art, you know, whether. Mm. And so I sort of started to learn how to do things in a different way and working kind of by myself and blah, blah, blah. And a couple years later, you know, I said, Tom, why don't you come back in a while, and then we'll see what we can talk again. And he came back about a year and a half, 2 years later, and then we did a show together in '90. So that was sort of that's how I started. And then there was little things here and there that we did also, not with Tom, but with the actually opened. I started a gallery with a friend, Ken Riddle. It was in Pasadena and things like that. So there were kind of funky things going on in LA.
I didn't know about that gallery that you started. So with Ken, you started a gallery in Pasadena. That was after your first show. That was in the early '90s.
It was before that. I think it was with him and his girlfriend at the time and myself and it was called Bliss. It was at his house. Ken's dad had made a lot of money in real estate in Manhattan Beach, and so he bought him a house when he was still a student at Art Center. And I was his roommate, and then we had a garage, so we did a show at the garage of the house, and it was called the Bliss House because it was made for this Dr. Bliss in 1920 or something like that. And it actually became kind of a space where a lot of people got their first shows in LA, and I think it was documented. I mean, there was a show, I think somewhere in Santa Barbara or something that kind of documented the history of it about 5 or 10 years ago. And, you know, people like Diana Thayer, Pei White, Sam Durant, all those people did kind of their first shows there. Their first shows, and by their first shows, I mean shows that actually, you know, some of them actually got reviewed and blah, 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 and that sort of, you know, catapulted them into getting galleries and things like that. So.
but reviewed out of that garage.
Yeah. Yeah, in Pasadena on Washington Avenue.
Fascinating, right? I mean, there's so many stories like that, or maybe not so many, but artists who get together with friends, create shows in apartments, even in rural areas, and end up getting them reviewed, and it kind of launches their career. So that's kind of what happened with you and a number of artists there that helped all of you to launch your careers in a sense.
Yeah, they just became venues so you could kind of, you know, put things on display and kind of see what they did. And but also LA at that time was really nothing in LA. So it was, you know, there were a lot of spaces were really more, they were domestic. I mean, I can't remember the names of them. There were like a half a dozen spaces going on at the same time. Or, you know, at least a few consequent years after there's. That's sort of where like something like 3 Day Weekend comes from, which Dave Mueller's project is probably the one that's kind of best known. And
right.
there were others too. Right after the recession of '87, there wasn't that much to begin with in LA. But then there was even less. So people, you know, there were tons of LA was probably, you know, producing more kind of more serious MFAs and MFA students than anywhere else in the country at the time. So you had a lot of artists coming out, and not a lot of places to show, and you either got catapulted out of LA and then something would happen, or you would get stuck there. So different a bit now, but quite a bit. So.
And what was the next point for you where you became, I suppose, a full-time artist, where your career shifted from now you are an artist, this is what you want to do, and you're letting go of your day job. When did that happen?
Well, I left my day job in 96, I think, or 95. I graduated in 88, and I had a full-time job until like 96, I had a job at the library at Art Center. I was the circulation desk supervisor. I ran the circulation desk with Steve Hansen, who actually now is a dealer in LA. He owns China Art Objects, the gallery, and we worked together there for many years, and a lot of artists worked there, like, you know, not a lot, but actually a fair amount, like some of the known ones, like Diana Fader worked there, and a lot of people like that. But, and, you know, I was doing a lot of work from, you know, like I said, from the time I graduated, I was in shows and, you know, from the 90s on, group shows and solo shows and blah, blah, blah.
So it's 1996, and that was a year, it was kind of a breakout year for you, if I can use that. You're having shows all over the world. Things are really changing, and you're letting go of your job.
Yeah, it was kind of a weird high anxiety period for me because I'd never not had a job. My parents always said, you got to have a job so you can have health insurance. But you know, I'd always had a job, like, you know, a full time job, like, you know, it was a great job. I didn't have to do anything at the library. I had a fax. I could work on my work, but I had to be there. So by 96, I'd been a lot of exhibitions in Europe. I was basically traveling to Europe back and forth, you know, 3-4 months a year. I mean, a job paid nothing. I mean, it paid, I think when I started, it paid like $13,000. I was maybe making $18,000 a year when I left. And it finally got to the point where I was doing my taxes with an accountant for the first time. And he said, like, well, you made this much money selling art, and you made this much money on your job. Maybe you should quit your job. And I go, okay, that makes sense. And then and I did. And that's sort of what happened.
And was there, so that was multiple shows all over the place. It wasn't one gallery in particular that was making.
No, I was happen. By then I was working. I was already working with Betzel New York, with Steiger and Schneider in Europe, and Ivo Capitaine. I was already working on the Munster project. I'd been in a, you know, half a dozen.
And all those connections kind of came out of your activity in LA and the garage and what was starting.
Yeah, the garage. Started it. All those relationships in Europe really came out of working with Tim Neuger and Max Hetzler and meeting Petzold around the same time, and you know, it also, for some reason, I have this German, these Germans all took a liking to me at the same time, and even though I was in L.A., and it all sort of blossomed into what I do now. But
So that almost brings us up to the present. I mean, so then you keep exhibiting with Petzl, and you still are, correct? You're represented by Petzl?
Yeah.
And, you know, a number of other places, in Gagosian. I saw the installations at Dia. That's when, you know, I thought, God, you know, this is gorgeous work. I love seeing that. In retrospect, as you kind of built this career, is there anything you would have done differently?
Not really. I mean, I don't think I would know how to do it differently. I think it all happened really organically, and it's just sort of about just kind of following your instincts and kind of getting ripped off by people and just understanding by hitting your head and it wasn't. No, I mean, I don't. I mmean, if you think about it, you could do a lot of things different. But at the time, I don't think I would have. I mean, it's incredibly lucky, really, to do what I do and make a living at it, and make a good living at it. So, I don't know. No, I don't know what I would do differently. I would, everything. You know, 99% of what happened to me pretty much fell on my lap, and I just kind of walked through the hole and came out the other side, and it was all right. Yeah, but I didn't. I certainly didn't think about it with, you know, thinking that I was looking to make money or have a career as a might. I realized early on that, you know, if you're an artist, you're probably not going to make a living. You're doing it because you like it, and you're kind of lazy in a way, because, you know, having real jobs is a lot harder. It's much more boring.
But this has turned into quite a real job for you. I mean, that's why at the beginning when we were talking about, you know, you have all these assistants, multiple projects. That sounds.
Yeah, but that turns into what it is. It's not something that you program, and it's just more like, you know, having a bunch of assistants, to be honest, is a pain in the ass. I have them because of, you know, the ambition of the work I want to make and stuff like that. But it would be much, much easier not to have any and, you know, make paintings and stuff, sell them for a lot of money. You know, making sculptures is a pain in the ass.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I'm just lucky. I like it.
That's good. Jorge, it's been great talking to you. Is there... In closing, I just want to ask, is there exhibitions in New York or other places that listeners should go to? This is airing in 2015 this month, so is there anywhere in particular in New York or the States?
Not in the States. I don't think we're doing anything in the States in a gallery this year. We're working on some projects, public projects. I think one of them might open here, but it might not. And then there's an exhibition in London that we have in October, and there's just a bunch of commissions, so it's not a lot of gallery stuff going on. I usually do one or two gallery shows a year. So.
And lastly, is there anything, there are a lot of artists listening to this broadcast, you know, young artists, mid-career artists, different kinds, is there anything, you know, and everyone's working on their art in their own way, is there any piece of I hesitate to say advice, information that you'd want to leave with the listeners?
I don't have any good advice for anybody, but other than, I mean, if you're stupid enough to take something like this on, it better be about something real, like how you feel, opposed to what you think you might get, or something like that. I don't know.
No, that's interesting, and I mean, as opposed to thinking about it, I mean, in terms of like money or gain, it being about something that's from the heart.
Maybe about the heart is too sentimental, but maybe about pleasure. You know, that pleasure drives things very deeply for a very long time.
Jorge, thanks so much for talking with us today.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.